Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we talk to foresters about how they are using digital technologies in their day-to-day forestry work. Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Preston Green. He's the Assistant VP of CTL Systems at Miller Timber Services. Preston, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing good, Kevin. How are you?
Good, good. No complaints since the last time I saw you. So we were joking earlier that you're actually at home for, by the sounds of it, less like 12 hours to go now. quick hello in the office. But where's home for you? Where am I reaching you today?
So I am from Western Oregon. And so that's where our home office is located, a small town named Philomath, just outside of Corvallis, Oregon.
Very cool. Very cool. And I remember when we met in person, some of us were like, which one of us is right? We had a bet in whether it was Philomath or some other pronunciation. You looked at us with this look and said, you're all wrong. It's like pronounced differently. So it's Philomath. So we were all wrong on that one, but beautiful country over there. So maybe to kick us off, I always like to ask our guests how they got into forestry, because you studied forestry, you have a bachelor's degree in forest engineering from Oregon State University. You also decided to go do two masters, but we'll get to that at some point. But maybe share with me and our listeners your journey into the forestry space, something from home or landed on it, or is there a cool story there?
Yeah, well, I guess it's probably somewhat typical of what a lot of people, or how a lot of people come to forestry, at least in this part of the world. I had an upbringing where we were outdoors a lot, hunting and fishing as a kid with my dad and grandpa and rest of the family. And I remembered hearing stories from my dad and grandpa about when they were my age and they were hauling logs out of the forest here in Western Oregon. They did that back in the 80s and 90s when timber was a totally different game than it is today. But I still just kind of remember the kind of the grandeur of the stories about hauling logs in the West, back in the day. And so, forestry wasn't actually my original career path. It wasn't what I wanted to go into. I was originally a candidate for the Air Force Academy, but, as things happen and as life goes on, things change. And so I found myself looking at opportunities at Oregon State for forestry after the Air Force Academy didn't work out. So I grew up with it and then found the program at OSU and took a couple classes my second term there and then said, this is awesome. And the rest is history, so to speak. And I've loved it ever since. And so that's been 12 years ago since that all went down and really haven't looked back.
Very cool. Very cool. And now I guess it connects the dots, because I remember you had mentioned to me that you had your pilot's license, but you were going for IFR training. And then now I guess it connects the dots where that passion or interest came from, that you've always had air legs and maybe now forced legs as well.
So sure.
Thinking of your studies, you're at OSU now, you also decided to pursue, I had to rub my eyes twice because I was like, okay, a master's degree. And then I was like, wait, is there a posting error here? There's another master's degree that I'm like, no, I think these are they're not the same. No, they're separate, but they're the same time. But I think you got two master's degree. Tell us about how that journey came about, because I think it was reasonably close in terms of proximity with wrapping up the undergrad, a bit of experience, and then right into the master's degree. Tell us about that.
Yeah. It was pretty much right after I finished my undergraduate work. So about my junior year, during my undergrad, I took a forest operations course here at OSU and really enjoyed that. Really, really thought that was something I could see myself doing in the future, and got to learn more about some upcoming technology in the realm of steep slope harvesting. And that really piqued my interest as well. And the professor in that forest operations class was a really awesome professor. And so they really kind of sparked my interest in what could be a potential opportunity and path for a graduate program. So I went from, my sophomore year saying, there's no way in heck I'm doing grad school, give me my 4-year degree and then I'm out of here, to about 6 months later during my junior year saying, now I'm considering two master's degrees. And so, the I decided to go with a Master of Science in Forest Management and pursue a research focus in steep slope harvesting systems. And I had a business interest as well. And so I tacked on a Master's in Business Administration in the supply chain side, also at Oregon State. So I made the deal with my major professor that if I stuck around for 3 years to do both programs, then I'd help him with another year's worth of research work. So we kind of had a gentleman's agreement and said, let's figure something out here and make this work. And so I stuck around for 3 years and finished the Master of Science on the forestry side, and then the MBA on the business side. So you're right, it was right after undergraduate. My undergraduate program finished up, and then 3 years right in a row to get the two master's degrees.
Very cool, very cool. So now I'm worried because if you ever decide to go do a PhD, I'm not sure whether you're going to get two of them or four of them or 12 of them. I don't know, but clearly one of the high achievers over here, the one of this guy we're talking to. So I think that's probably a good segue. Maybe introduce us to your role at Miller Timber Services, and maybe introduce us to Miller Timber Services, the company itself. Because it was totally cool learning more about what you do, and it's maybe broader than most of our listeners probably are aware of, but or maybe they don't even know about Miller Timber Services, depending where they are geographically. But maybe introduce us to Miller Timber Services and what the organization's involved with as a as an organization and business.
Sure, yeah. So Miller Timber Services was founded in, I think, 1980 here in Western Oregon, a small town called Siletz. It's about an hour west of here, and it's right on the coast. So you're, gosh, probably 20 miles from the ocean in the town of Siletz. And so it got started over there, and it got started primarily as more of a reforestation business. So doing all kinds of work to help get young trees up and established in the realm of like PCT work and thinning applications, hand thinning applications, things like that. But fast forward 44 years, 45 years to today, and we're a nationally recognized forestry contract services provider. And so we have one, two, three, really four main divisions in the company. So one of them being we still have the reforestation division, and so they plant millions of seedlings every year. I think it's usually in the neighborhood of 5 to 7 million seedlings across the West here. But they also do all kinds of other work like burning, spraying, anything that's involved with getting a young stand of trees up and established and up and growing. So reforestation is one. We also have the wildland fire division, where we have a large number of hand crews every year. We have engines, we have tenders, other resources that go out and fight wildland fire. Our third division, which I work in and under, is the cut-to-length division. And so we have a fleet currently of just over 50 Ponce harvesters and forwarders, and those machines are operational across the lower 48 United States, doing a variety of thinning and forest restoration work. These machines also do work on fire in the summertime, so we kind of double dip into the wildland fire division in the summertime. So that keeps us very busy here on the CTL side. And then last but not least, we have our trucking side of the business as well. So whether it's logs or machines, we have our own fleet of trucks to move those resources around and really serve as a support role for the CTL division.
Wow, lots there for sure. I know when I was looking at the website on the wildfire side of things, there's also a fitness level that has to be met to be able to participate, which may explain why you also are a runner, maybe. I don't know, or maybe it's just being ready if you're called on. But I think I pulled my hamstring just reading the description of having to carry a rucksack for like 3 miles or something in 45 minutes, and that was the low bar. I just felt my hamstring go right there and say like, no, I'm not even gonna try it personally. But very cool breadth of different businesses, business lines that you're involved with. So maybe we'll focus a little bit more on yours because there's a lot there, and I think for maybe some of the folks that are not as familiar with CTL systems or cut the length, maybe could you explain to us like the decision to go the CTL route, tree length, you know, with a bunch of processor, buncher, skitter, forwarder. Did that just not make sense, or what was? Can you share with us some of the thinking to decide to go all in with Ponces and those harvesters?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that really is kind of crucial to the development of the miller timber services that people know today in regards to our Ponce equipment and what we do on that side of the business. So we used to have tower yarders. We used to be a yarder logging business, and that was primarily the tool that was used to do the thinning work that we were doing at the time. But as yourself and probably most listeners and viewers will know, that side of logging and that method in particular is pretty dangerous. And so eventually it just came to a point where the owner of the company, Lee Miller, and the head management at that time, they kind of all looked around and said, we're not really, we don't have the same passion for yarder logging that we used to. And just the challenges that are surrounding trying to grow and maintain a yarder business were pretty tough. And that was about the time where some of this CTL technology started to come around. And Lee is very creative, and he's always looking to adapt and grow. And so he kind of caught wind of this. And I believe, if memory serves me right, he started actually doing cut to length work in the 90s. He still had yarders at that time, and so it was kind of a hybrid model. He was running both systems. And then eventually, as I mentioned, they just kind of looked around and said, I don't know if these are the way to go. And the CTL technology was starting to grow, and technological innovation was starting to come around to where they could get on steeper and steeper slopes. And eventually the decision was made to just divest all of the yarder sides and go with these cut to length systems. And Ponce has been an absolutely wonderful partner in terms of providing us the equipment that we need and making technological improvements that allow us to get on steeper slopes more efficiently and more safely. And it's really just grown from there. I think our first Ponce tethered machine was in 2015, I want to say, something like that. And I think our first Ponce machine was all the way back in 2004. So a full 20 years now with Ponce machines and really about a decade's worth of steep slope experience.
Yeah, very, very cool, very interesting. And so when we think about that and your journey with the technology, how has it changed for you in the sense of just even a short period of time? Because technology is changing very, very quickly. But for maybe the machine side of things, have they gotten bigger, faster, cheaper? No, not cheaper, right? Definitely not cheaper, for sure. But over the last 5 years, how would you describe that change that probably leads to more productivity, maybe more efficiency? Certainly, safety is always in everyone's top foremost thoughts there. But is there something that you've seen in terms of the CTL technology, the systems that you wouldn't have expected to have come about so quickly?
Well, I think the biggest game changer was probably being able to put a winch on these machines. That really helped access probably, gosh, I don't even know what a good number would be, but a much bigger portion of ground that we otherwise wouldn't have been able to access and kind of build our reputation on. So certainly just the mechanical improvements in design, they've made improvements to where the machines can handle bigger trees and bigger logs, and do so with more control and more power. Probably one of the more recent ones that's kind of been exciting to see is the development of the Mammoth Forwarder. That machine is capable of carrying, I think a 23 to 25 ton payload, which is substantial for a forwarding machine. And it's big too. It's very big. So we talk about machines getting bigger. That is certainly the case with the Mammoth, and it's appropriately named because of its size. It's quite the big machine. So machines are getting bigger. They're getting stronger. But what I think is really fascinating at the same time is that they're actually also getting more efficient. So one of the things I nerd out about here in my role is getting to look at fuel consumption. And these machines have gotten more and more fuel efficient. When we talk about liters burned per cubic meter of wood harvested, they become more and more efficient over time. And but at the same time, they're also getting more powerful. So we're getting kind of the best of both worlds. We're decreasing our operating costs in terms of fuel efficiency, and we're increasing our productivity to go with it. So that, of course, is due to improvements in powertrains. And I think the next big step on that is really EV powertrains. And Ponce has built and developed EV1, a forwarder that is an electric vehicle forwarder, but still a little ways out from serial production. But really interesting to see what's going to happen there in the future when we talk about gains in efficiencies and improvements and operating costs.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because that was something I was thinking about when you were mentioning that, and I normally save the future questions for later, but since this got brought up around the whole fuel side of things, like the electrification route, for sure, efficiency and traditional fuels for sure. But have you heard anything, not just Ponce, but other folks in terms of other fuels, like we hear about the whole hydrogen thing, et cetera, or do you kind of see it the world really? Maybe like in our consumer markets where you got ICE, you got EV, and you got hybrid, and everyone wants a hybrid, but well, some even want to wait 4 years. But is there something in between, I guess, that electrification and the traditional fuels, in your world with this heavy equipment that you've heard about?
Not necessarily anything that I've heard about. I think the EV stuff with Ponce is probably a logical next step. And I think that's really the key, right? Is that, we got to make a logical next step. And that's probably in the realm of a hybrid powertrain. If I had to guess, that's where I would say things are going to go. Who knows? We might look back on this in 5 years and say, wow, we totally missed the mark on that one. But, I guess either way, it's going to be exciting to see what happens.
Well, I guess first step, I want to see some of those Miller Timber F-150 Lightnings, not those 350 Supermaxes or whatever you got there first, right? But that's a whole nother story there on operational realities there. So we think about that in terms of your space. I know you're also involved with other research initiatives. So before we go there, I just wanted to kind of before I lost my thought about this steep slope harvesting, because I'm not an expert, and depending where you are geographically, I guess in the world, like you could be flat as a pancake or on steep slopes, and it's secondhand. But I was wondering if you can maybe describe the mechanics of how you actually go about harvesting. Like sounds like the harvesters are anchored or tethered. Are the forwarders as well? Or maybe can you describe that lay of the land for a typical job that you might do?
Both machines do have winches on them. The harvester, if you're sitting in the cab, the winch is behind you, because the harvester is going to cut trees facing downhill, and so they don't want that winch line in front of them, potentially dropping trees on that winch line. So they've got a full view in front of them to cut trees, and that winch is behind them, anchoring them up to the top of a hill. And that anchor can be anything from just a solid tree. I see the tree in your background there. That one's certainly big enough to tether on, but we can also use a piece of equipment as well. It just depends on whatever is available. We don't have to have monster trees. It's not like we're fully dangling, a 55,000-pound machine out there. It's really only using about 10 tons of pulling force to anchor that machine up there. So, pretty, I guess, pretty moderate requirements for what we need to sufficiently anchor. But yeah, both machines will tether. Harvester, the tether, the winch is right behind the cab. On the forwarder, the winch is actually underneath the bunks of the machine, because the forwarder is going to collect logs in the bunks, and then it's going to travel uphill. So it needs that winch to be on the uphill side of the machine. So I guess that's a good way to think of it. You're cutting downhill and you're forwarding uphill, but either way, that winch is on the uphill side of the machine.
Okay, very cool. I feel like I would be screaming no matter which direction I was going at the top of my lungs, operating getting lowered down. You're putting a lot of trust in these systems and these machines, and yeah, it's I assume it's not the faint for those with a faint of heart, I suppose, but.
It is certainly kind of a wild ride when you get in the first time and experience being on, a 70, 80% slope. I think cutting trees is probably a little more nerve-wracking, I guess, because one, you're looking downhill, and so you can see all that ground in front of you. But in the forwarder, you're laying back and you're just looking uphill. So you don't see all the business behind you with the steep slopes. You just kind of lay back and pick up your trees and keep walking up the hill. So you know, between the two, I definitely prefer going on steep terrain in the forwarder.
Very cool. Now, I know thinking of that, you also do some work in terms of clearing steep slopes for skiing, I believe. And so I'm just wondering, do you get to enjoy the fruits of the labor? You do the work, and then after, assuming there's enough snow, you get to go back and get a free lift pass and get some free runs in, or yeah?
Well, I personally don't ski or snowboard. I've only snowboarded once, and that was, gosh, probably 15 years ago, I'd say. And I've never done it since. So never been a hobby of mine, but we do have another manager, and they're in charge of all the mountain services stuff, as we call it. And certainly, yeah, that's right up his alley. So he does get to go ski on these places and look at them before we get in there and do our restoration work, and then check them out afterwards. And from what I've heard, it's pretty good skiing afterwards. So, but those guys would know better than I would.
I feel like your CTO job inbox is going to be this big, really small, then the mountain services inbox for career applications will be like out of the box, so out of the inboxes people apply looking for the exotic jobs there.
For
So
sure.
thinking, maybe moving on from that topic, and then thinking of when we had chatted way back. Now you have a nickname, and I'm not sure if this should be disclosed, but I'm going to disclose it anyways, unless you jump in and go like, oh, no, it's like you can't. So for our audience, Preston has a very unique nickname, and it's called the Opti Assassin. So maybe break that down for us. I think most of us can figure out the assassin part, but maybe break the Opti part. What does that mean, and why have you been lovingly assigned this nickname?
Thanks for bringing that up, Kevin. Really appreciate that. So the Opti Assassin. So I've been with Miller for just over 5 years now, and kind of specialize in the technology and development and software side of what we do. So as part of that, when I was young, early in my career here, I had to kind of figure out the computer system that ran the harvesters, and that is known as Opti. So that's where the Opti part comes in. So Opti is unlike any other software program I've ever seen. It's not like opening up Word or Excel or anything like that. It's got its own unique nuances, I guess you could say. And I figured out how to break it. And I didn't do it just once. I think I did it twice. So I kind of got a little bit of a reputation for assassinating Opti computer systems, and hence the nickname came up. But fast forward 5 years, and I've kind of learned a few lessons, and I'm kind of the go-to guy around here now for any computer software related issues that creep up in those machines. But yeah, I had to kind of learn the hard way. Had to break it first before I learned how it worked.
That's the best way. So you're Opti Assassin, and maybe now Opti Jedi Master. And I'm sure maybe back then when your call came in to Ponce support, people were freaking out, going like, "Oh no, it's Preston!" It's like, "No, I don't want to take the call. We'll cycle him and see what newbie's gonna pick up this call." But that's cool. But what better way to learn the technology than breaking it? And so we think about that on the technology side. I'm curious to know your thoughts on a few items, because I know you're involved with a lot of, you're the liaison with Miller Timber Services and various research organizations in the US and even abroad. I believe you have quite a bit of flexibility, or at least that was the sense I got in terms of pursuing things of interest and value to Miller Timber, whether in the lower 48 or even in Florence, Italy, Firenze, Italy. Yes, tough life. Where are you, Preston, this week? Oh, I'm in Florence. I'm like, oh, doing what? And like, oh, at a conference. And I think it was the Formac conference. But thinking of that and the work that you do with the liaison work, is there a certain trend you're seeing with the types of an industry academia type of projects that you're supporting, and what would those trends you're seeing that maybe the folks in the ivory towers are chasing, or the industry organizations that are mandated with that type of innovation?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it is starting to shift, and it's starting to change in what folks are looking at and thinking about. So I think a common theme that has been around since I was doing my grad work is still a lot of interest in the environmental impacts of these CTL systems. You know, with it being a relatively new technology to the United States, there isn't this plethora of research work that's been done. So I think that's ongoing. And I think just within the last, well, really within the last year, I've started to see a shift in interest going towards AI and forestry operations that could benefit, or how to look at different things through an AI perspective. And I think particularly from what I saw at that Formec conference that you mentioned in the fall of 2023, I think it's at more of a theoretical stage right now, you know, as AI technology and software develops. It will move more into practical, I think, but now it's a theoretical, you know, how do we incorporate AI into these systems levels approaches to forestry, and what does that mean for all kinds of issues, right? I mean, you can apply, gosh, I mean, just pick a topic: operations, emissions, silviculture, right? And I think that's where a lot of these theoretical conversations are leading, is how do we leverage AI into some of these classic forestry concepts and really modernize what we're talking about here? So I think that's probably going to be the next big wave of technology that comes out, and research topics that get presented is around artificial intelligence and forestry.
Interesting, interesting. And for our audience, Formec is, you're going to have to help me out, force mechanical engineering. Not close.
I believe it's forestry mechanization, I think.
Mechanization. Okay,
But
there we go. There we go. It was in
if the
Italy. It's
board's
going to be
listening.
in Sweden this year. So there's always these exotic places. So it's interesting to hear you say AI. And so I'm wondering, because you're an expert in the space, you know at least the Panzer line of machines, the Opti systems inside and out. If you're thinking of Miller and you were to talk to, let's say, Lee and say, "Hey, got this great idea. Someone's asking for a bajillion dollars for this AI project." From a pragmatic or maybe practical space, how would you frame that story? And the only reason I ask is because there's a lot of AI conversations now, and AI means different. Are you talking about generative AI? Are you talking about more of a traditional, just better training, we can spit things out, more deterministic in some respects. And so it means a lot of things. And I don't want to say it's a blow word, but at the same time, at times when I talk with people, it feels like this nebulous, like, AI thing. And some folks say, you know what, AI is not going to take your job. It's the person who's using AI that's going to take your job. And I always like that distinction because it's like, oh, it's true. I'm not sure we're quite there yet that things have advanced to this world where a lot of people are afraid of. And I believe there's merit in some of those fears. But in terms of when you think about AI and your day-to-day work, is there a use case that you're like, gee whiz, if I just had some AI bought AI something, that would help? What would you vision, I guess, thinking of what the future could look like?
I can't say that I've had that question before, but that's a really, you know, that one, that's enough to kind of really make your brain think. Just off the top of my head, I kind of thought of two different ways that could go. And one, since we are a contractor, of course, we're heavily involved in operations, and AI could, I could see that reducing the human workload of having to figure out who's going where and who's doing what. But then also really leveraging that to optimize how we assign our resources, right? Whether it's just operators and individual harvest units. Of course, excuse me, something that's going to require an extravagant amount of data. But essentially putting the right guy in the right place at the right time, right? There's a lot of operational efficiency that I would guess could be gained from something like that, from an AI approach. So I think operational improvements and how AI can facilitate that network, because that's what we spend our jobs doing every day, right? It's just who's going where, who's doing what, is it working properly, how do we fix it, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the other side, I think about a little bit bigger picture, and I think, okay, how can AI be leveraged across the entire supply chain, right? If you think about it, we're kind of the second step in the forestry supply chain. The first step, of course, is the landowner. You know, they have to plant the trees and grow them and whatnot, and then we'll harvest them and truck them. But we're the second step, third step being the mill or manufacturing facility, and then likely going on to a consumer after that. But really thinking about those first three, how can AI improve the communication and data flow between those first three entities, landowner, contractor, manufacturing facility? Because that really, I would guess, would allow us to make data-driven decisions, right? And if we know more information going into these decision-making conversations and times, then there's probably some efficiencies that can be gained there as well. Now, you know, how exactly will that look? Gosh, I don't know if we have enough time for that today. Right? But just that concept of data transformation, data sharing, you know, and how does that actually become valuable information to the parties, to the different parties in the supply chain?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And for our audience who don't know Miller Timber, you folks as contractors are probably one of the most advanced contracting company, you know, I've seen in all honesty in terms of how the technology you're using and how you're thinking about technology and how you're actually rolling out and implementing new technologies, even if in a pilot mode or different capacities there. So it's very cool. Definitely encourage folks to learn more about Miller Timber Services. And so I guess if we kind of like go further away, you're also in charge of, well, I guess I shouldn't say in charge of, but involved with, maybe fingers in the jar maybe, but on the trucking side and some of those other service lines that Miller's involved with. And so what are you seeing on that side as you think about you know, your roles? I'm paraphrasing, but very focused on, you know, the operational side and gaining efficiencies and doing things well and keeping everyone safe, of course. But maybe on the trucking side, you know, getting to that third part, you know, the mill, the folks manufacturing the products, are you seeing anything interesting from a technologies point of view or a trends point of view from that contractor's lens?
I think there's kind of fragmented things that are happening on the transportation side as it relates to forestry. One place is the paper tickets at mills, right? You know, a truck shows up on a job, they get a paper ticket written out from the loader operator, get a few copies of that. They take that load to the mill, they get a few copies from the mill. And that is really an archaic process, right? I mean, gosh, we don't, that'd be like us. That'd be like you and me, Kevin, writing letters back and forth to each other to communicate with stuff, you know, and dropping it in the mail. You know,
I won't
so.
send you my letter to my pen pal Preston Green, then I'll put that aside then
Yeah. A couple decades late for that.
and
But that's kind of the same concept with load tickets, right? And so I think that's probably a really big area for improvement. And there are, like I said, that's kind of there's fragmented things going on. It seems like in my experience, whether we're out west or down in the US South or anywhere in between, everybody's doing their own thing for how they want that process to look and what information they're collecting. There's not really one unified standard player or system that seamlessly, and that's the key word, seamlessly translates that information from the contractor to the landowner to the mill and anywhere in that loop, right? Everybody kind of has their own process, and then if you want to get information from another entity, well, you kind of have to learn their process and be a part of that process. All of a sudden, you've got three, four, five different independent processes going on where it's really the same information that's being shared back and forth. It's just volumes and tracking numbers is all we're talking about. So, I mean, gosh, we have the likes of Amazon that can ship however many millions of packages a day. And I guarantee you, they're not printing load tickets for these things going back and forth. So why is it that, you know, us in trucking, that industry is so far behind in terms of just modernizing and speeding up that data flow? So, Gosh, I got on a tangent there, Kevin. You got me riled up there, but
No, it's a good one. And so for the Amazon truck driver who's listening to the digital podcast, please, Digital Forester podcast, please destroy that paper ticket you have. Otherwise, Preston's going to come to your door and rip it open. But you touch on an interesting point there, because no matter what technology we talk about, it seems like in forestry, everyone tries to do it themselves, or they argue that they're unique or it's too complex, and thus I got to do it myself. But what do you think from your seat, as a contractor? Because often, when I talk with different folks, they're all, across the food chain of this business of forestry with different views. But as a contractor, sometimes I guess you're forced to say, hey, I got to use this system because maybe landowners adopted this, or the mills, or whatever the supply chain dictates as the standard operating protocols here, I got to comply with it. But from your seat, kind of, working for so many different people, why do you think it's so fragmented with people with different things? Like, why do you think, is it because foresters just like to be in the bush by themselves and not talk to people, that this is just a outcome of that? They just think in this isolated way. But why, like, this doesn't seem like something really hard to solve, I guess, is what I'm saying. And why do you think it's so hard to solve?
I think it's partially so hard to solve because these systems have been in place for a long time, right? So you're trying to buck decades of ingrained processes in these organizations. And as much as I hate to say it, we kind of tend to be an industry that is a little slow to change, right? We're not on the technological forefront if you think about the whole technology world as a whole. We're not at the leading edge of that. And so I think that's probably the biggest thing. These systems are just kind of old, and they've been around for a long time and ingrained in these businesses. And so it takes a lot of effort and energy for these things to change. Now, that's how to go about doing that. We're trying to figure out little ways and things like that to get people on the same page. But I think a big part of at least in forestry is getting everybody to be comfortable seeing what be comfortable that they can trust what they're seeing, right? They can trust that this load report is accurate, and it is actually what shipped this day or this week or whatever. And not to say that people aren't trustworthy or anything like that, not at all, but it's just I think it's just getting people used to seeing a different format of the same information in a little different way.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, I often think of it of there is an element of trust there, but maybe not the personal trust, but more around the data integrity and the completeness. And it's almost like once that's accepted, then there's no more questions that are asked. And sometimes it's almost like it swings too far in the pendulum, where there's other issues that pop up, but folks have already moved beyond that, and they're trusting the systems just to report them as is. So thinking of future tech, maybe I'm just going to open it up because you're a young guy, you're a runner, so I'm sure you're running, listening to like 50 podcasts because you're trying to be fit for that wildfire training program there. But when you think about broad technology as a whole, what gets you excited for tomorrow, what the future could be? Are there certain themes that you're looking at or thinking about?
I think so. One is just an ability to see everything that's going on in my own fleet, right? Everything that's going on, whether it is here in Western Oregon or in the US South, or in the Rocky Mountains, just being able to have a pulse on where things are at and what they're doing. Because I can't be everywhere in one day, even as much as I do run, I can't run everywhere, but just I think having visibility into what we have going on across the country. But then that's really just the first step. And where I want to see that go in the future is having that whole supply chain connected. So I think it would be great if we could be able to tell mills what was coming at them on a daily basis, right? What are the products that they're going to get? They can plan their scheduling, they can plan their manufacturing, they can plan their sales, or vice versa. If they have sales projections and they say, hey, we think this product is going to be really hot, can you optimize your harvesters to cut this certain type of product out of these trees? Well, yes, we can. We just need the information first. So I think it's that broader level connectivity to all the parties involved that we're working with, but then being able to react to those little changes on the fly. When the market changes, when mill operations change, when our capabilities change, from in terms of accessing different types of terrain or whatever it may be, being able to capitalize on those opportunities and be able to drive value for the whole supply chain as a result of that. So that's really where I want to see things go in the future is how do we create value across the supply chain? Because timber and forestry, depending on who you talk to and when you talk to them, there's a lot of challenges that face the industry. So if we can figure out how to drive value, the saying a rising tide lifts all boats, that's where we want to be.
For sure. Very, very cool. And what do you think some of the challenges you might face in realizing that vision? And really, I'm thinking, because it's hot in my brain from a couple events I've been to recently, just around the workforce. And it seems like, on one side, a forestry specific event really highlighted that they're the shortage of a workforce is maybe, I don't want to say worse than it is, but maybe there's fewer bodies or boots that are really available. And then when I think, and that was on the state side, and when I think on the Canadian side, I was at an event that was not forestry specific, but just immigration in general for Canada. It was even more of a doomsday picture where there's just not enough people. It's like folks aren't forming families, having kids, and then at least on the Canadian side, we're really relying on immigration, and even then we're halting a lot of that. And we think of the baby boomers that are retiring quickly, faster and faster. There's more and more a shortage of. It's only going to get worse. So as a contracting organization, I'm assuming that people are critical to your success, the guys in the shops, the guys operating, you folks in the office and the admin. Are you seeing that pain point? And if so, what are some of your strategies that at least the ones you're able to share that y'all have been thinking about and putting in place to make sure that, that boat, when it finally does rise, or that tide, that there's folks there in the boats and ready to take advantage of that tsunami of opportunities. What can you share on that front?
Yeah, you're certainly right. Workforce is always a challenge, and it goes beyond just hiring and training. Everything that comes after that is equally as important too. We commonly joke that we have to fight like we're the third monkey trying to get on the ark, right? And that goes for people as well, right? We have to try and attract and retain good talent. One strategy that we have on our side, which is really great, is just the machines themselves, right? The technology that's in them and the low environmental impact that's associated with these systems. It's a really natural selling point. So if we're talking about operators, we're attracting a lot of people that are 30 or younger, I'll say, and are interested in the fact that they still get to be out in the woods. They still get to see and get all the benefits of that, but they're maybe not as it's not as demanding of a job as setting chokers or cutting trees by hand, right? They're in a climate-controlled cab. They can listen to their music. They still have to get their production for the day, but the creature comforts are there, and so that attracts a lot of people if they have an interest in forestry, or even if they don't. We've pulled people that haven't had a background in forestry and end up just falling in love with it because of all the benefits that come with being in forestry and the type of work that we do and the equipment that we have. So, to a large extent, the equipment sells itself, but we're also just trying to, get our names out there, right, and be relevant and establish, word of mouth relationships with people in the areas that we work and develop these things organically. And so, of course, sometimes that's hit and miss, but sometimes we actually get some really, really quality individuals for that as well. Another strategy that we have is owning and maintaining newer equipment, and that really helps, obviously, our uptime and productivity, but it also makes the mechanics' job easier. They're not dealing with as many catastrophic failures or higher severity failures if we were to have older equipment. And employees like that as well, right? They can pretty much count on Maybe every 5 years they're going to get a new machine, and so that's like getting a new office, every 5 years, and they get a fresh set of controls to work with and a whole new machine and everything. So just trying to keep ahead of some of those things before they become problems, I think, is really where we try and strive to be. And then of course also we try and compensate our employees pretty well and just provide a good livable wage and arguably above that in a lot of places. It comes with a lot of travel, right? And there's a lot of commitment to the line of work that we do, but we try and find a good balance there to where they're comfortable and happy with what they're doing for us.
Yeah, I think anyone in forestry or a forester in the business of forestry is used to the travel by road. You just go with it. I know I was talking to some family members and they're like, "Oh, it's really far to get there." I'm like, "Well, how long is a drive?" They're like, "Oh, it's 12 hours." I'm like, come on, 12 hours is nothing. You just get up at 3, 4 in the morning and you're there by mid-afternoon. But you're there for dinner. What's the problem?" And they all looked at me like I was a Martian, an alien from another planet. But I'm like, 12 hours, that's it. That's peanuts per se.
Sure.
So thinking of looking forward again with the CTL side of things, I'm dying to know, and I don't bring these thoughts together at some point, but I'm dying to know. There's always this narrative, CTL systems, the Harvester, the Forwarder model here. They're not rugged enough. They can't handle certain terrains, and that's why we gotta, go the tree length, right, with the buncher and the skidder and the processor. What are your thoughts on that? Is that mostly just noise, or viewpoints from another time? Is there merit to that in certain conditions the CTL systems just aren't really well suited for, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, or how I approach that question is, and this is true with a lot of things I look at if I'm looking at projects or deciding what we can and can't do. Like most tools, it can be used in the wrong way, right? We don't use a bicycle to travel from, Ottawa to Philomath, Oregon, right? It's not the right tool for the job. So that's, I think, where the first opportunity for improvement is making sure that the machine is in the right situation and stand type. Now, is it going to cut that big Doug fir? I assume it's a fir. It looks like a fir. Is it going to cut that big fir in the picture behind you? No, it's not meant to cut trees that are that big. So there is certainly a range of work that is more suited for a buncher. And typically that stops at tree size. Right? Terrain, man, really not much of an issue. We've been on ground that's 110% before. So I'll argue that we can pretty much go right up to where a yarder can go. Obviously in some places we can't always go where a yarder can go, but we can do a fair amount of ground that's pretty steep. Tree size, I think, is really the biggest limitation. These machines are nimble and they're flexible and they can work their way through a stand. I would say better than a buncher and a skidder can, and with less impact after the fact. Now these machines are articulated and they have bogies, and so they're just like a snake. They're just always kind of creeping and crawling and in touch with the ground versus a buncher or something of that nature with an excavator-based platform. They're all up or they're all down. So these CTL machines, they're conforming to the existing natural shape of the soil versus a buncher is going to force the soil to conform to the shape of that track. And so that obviously drives a lot of benefit from an environmental standpoint. That ground pressure is really low. Even with a full load of wood on a forwarder, it's still really low. But it also allows us to get into some areas that I don't think a buncher could get into.
Right. And so for those viewers, not listeners, this tree that Preston keeps referring to, I'm so strong I could reach into my virtual background here and just grab this sucker and
There you
throw it.
go.
Who needs a harvester or a buncher? You just need Kevin Lim. No, I'm just joking. It's from the West Coast. You're absolutely right there. And so maybe the last question before we look at winding down and to connect the dots here, we touched on communication. Tell me how you folks as an organization are handling this. Oh, I'm in the middle of nowhere and there's zero communication. Are you using I won't say advanced technologies, but maybe more readily consumer things we're aware in the consumer market. How are you handling this machines in the middle of nowhere and you having to be able to reach or connect to the internet from afar?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, probably the biggest development that we're making there is we're actually using Starlink mobile satellites to do that. And I think we've only got a few out across the landscape right now, but I think that's going to be something in the future where we're going to look back and say, I don't know how we really did things without these in place. And those of us that were around before all these technology advancements came about, we're going to say, well, we didn't do these things before before these opportunities were in place. So I think that's the big one. These Starlink satellites, leveraging those in remote areas and providing a data connection from there. I can remotely log into our harvesters across the country or forwarders for that matter. And if we need to update cutting specs or troubleshoot issues on the software side, or even if mechanics need to go in and troubleshoot settings and assess machine performance, we now have the capability to do some of that in some of these areas as a result of Starlink. So it sounds simple, right? Just get an internet connection out into the woods, and then we can all go home for the day.
So I think, as maybe if I try and connect some of the dots, listening to this conversation and teasing out some of the things you've said, it's from the communication side, sounds like, you as an organization, maybe not full adoption, but you've got enough Starlinks out there, not an issue. We can get communications in the field. And then that use case you described about seeing all your machines, and understanding where they are, using AI to maybe help with scheduling or resource optimization, those types of scenarios, all fascinating. But it doesn't sound like, we're so far out, like what you've described in that use case, that like it's so far in the future. It almost feels like, this is the art of the possible today, or maybe in the next year. Is that where your thinking is, that there's a lot of quick wins that can be realized with existing technology now, that it's great to think about, 2, 5 years out, and obviously AI is a key theme for you and Miller Timber. But is that a fair statement to say, hey, it's like, what we need is the ingredients to the recipe already out there. We just need to find, the right chef in our organization to kind of pull this together and make sure it tastes good. Is that I was gonna say that's a terrible analogy, but anyhow, is that kind of the thinking that you can kind of see a future that's not so far off, maybe closer than others may think?
Yeah, I think that's the case, and I think that's true. And that's as you were describing that's exactly what I thought of, is that, it's certainly not me developing this technology. I'm not out there creating software and launching satellites into space to get, satellite connectivity, internet connectivity. It's not me doing that, right? I'm just pulling people together, and I'm pulling resources together and saying, okay, you're great at this, you're great at this, you're great at that. How can we all work together for a common goal that is going to benefit all of us? But just getting the right people to engage in that conversation and lean in and try and understand that vision that we have about what this thing can look like in another year, in another couple of years, I really don't think we're that far off.
It's interesting you phrase it that way, because now that I think about other folks I've talked to, even on this podcast, that are digital foresters, whether they choose to subscribe to that label or not, but in some respects, like those that are the most successful are community builders, or people, fostering relationships, networking and sharing results, and how you just described it there was very well done, eloquent in terms of, where success probably truly comes from is people working together to realize a desired outcome. So very, very cool. So as we look to wind down, I know I've enjoyed chatting with you. I've actually learned a lot, because again, I'm more on the technology side, not in the weeds of, the operational side, and that's why some of these questions I feign as if there's somebody out there who doesn't know the answer. And it's really me, the dumb guy here, wanting to know the answer. So thank you for bearing with my questions. But thinking of the folks who are out there listening, and folks, maybe there's startups, maybe there's people thinking, oh, it's like I can help like Miller Timber with this. What's the best way for folks to reach you? Is it social? Is it the website or email, phone? How can folks get a hold of you directly, or how can folks get direct contact with the assistant VP of CTL Systems at Miller Timber? I say that because people are like, "Ooh, assistant VP, perfect person I want to chat with." But how can folks get a hold of you?
Sure, yeah. I'd say, first check out our website and just kind of see if there's something in there that piques your interest. If not able to do that, that's totally fine too. I'm happy to provide my contact information. So my direct email is just Preston, Preston, at millertimber.com, all common spelling. And happy to just chat with people if they got ideas or just want to throw stuff around. Great, let's talk about it. Like you mentioned, it's about building that network and that community, and that's how I actually came to know you, Kevin. I just got to talking with people, and then people said, "Hey, get a load of this guy, right? You probably really like chatting with him," and it's been great ever since. So yeah, happy to entertain any communication via email. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me, and then we can set up Zoom calls or a Teams call or just a regular old phone call too, whatever is easiest for folks.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, and 100%, Preston's one of the good guys. He enjoys chatting, loves to, push the art of the possible, wants to make change and do good. So, yeah, definitely reach out for those listeners that want to learn more going forward. So, hey man, thanks so much for joining. Really enjoyed the conversation. I promised I was going to get you out in 58 minutes. So we are just 2 minutes shy of that mark. So we're going to wind things down. So it was really good talking with you. Thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights about your world with the CTL systems and what you're doing with them with Miller Timber. Definitely appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me on, and look forward to hearing more from the Digital Forester.
Absolutely. Cool. We'll talk soon.